Welcome to Uptown Radio. It's May 2nd. I'm your host, Dominic Hall-Thomas.
And I'm Claire Davenport. After a heated week of student protests and arrests, Columbia's campus is on lockdown.
But it's not just students who are protesting for Gaza. ACT UP, an activism group that was created to combat the HIV/AIDS crisis, is also protesting the war.
In general, we tried to be provocative. We wanted to be provocative because we wanted attention to our issues.
And there's a new professional women's hockey league. It's a big step for women athletes, but there are still some scores to settle.
Equal pay and equal does not mean same. We will never be paid the same as the men. It's not going to happen.
A new jail is being built in Chinatown, and Trump's hush money trial continues. More on that later, but first, the headlines.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Early this morning, Los Angeles police began dismantling an encampment directed by protesters calling for an end to Israel's war against Hamas in Gaza. Police used flashbangs and bright lights to disperse the crowd, which had defied orders to leave.
All your businesses. If you do not do so, you may be arrested or subject to other police action.
President Biden said this morning that Americans have the right to protest, but they do not have the right to break the law. He also denounced anti-Semitism and Islamophobia, saying there is no place for hate speech of any kind in America. Students at more than half a dozen British universities have established encampments on campus this week to show support for their U.S. contemporaries. Villa Marx reports.
Students at universities in London, Manchester, Bristol, Sheffield, and Warwick pitched tents and erected barricades this week, matching similar actions in the United States and several other countries. At Goldsmiths University in southeast London, demonstrator Samira Ali said there may be more encampments to come.
There are now encampments around Britain, and there probably will be more to come. And we see ourselves as part of that collective struggle and part of that collective student movement, which is definitely on the front foot right now.
Many of the groups are demanding their college authorities divest from Israel and publicly support Palestinian education following the destruction of higher education institutions in Gaza. For NPR News, I'm Villa Marx in London.
The Biden administration is announcing a $3 billion investment for replacing old lead pipes used for drinking water. NPR's Ping Huang reports.
Lead pipes were banned from drinking water in the mid-1980s, but many homes predate that. EPA Administrator Michael Regan says it's time to get those lead pipes out.
The science has been clear for decades. There is absolutely no safe level of lead exposure, especially not for our children.
Under certain circumstances, lead from these pipes can leach into drinking water, causing brain damage to children and kidney problems in adults. According to EPA, the money could be used to replace about 20% of the estimated number of service lines still in use in the U.S. President Biden is making the funding announcement in North Carolina, a key swing state in the upcoming presidential election that voted Trump in 2020. Ping Huang, NPR News.
Shortly, the governor of Arizona is expected to sign legislation to repeal a Civil War-era law that prohibits almost all abortions in the state. But Ben Giles with member station KJZZ reports the ban will not be eliminated right away.
Well, the intent of repealing the 1864 ban is to let another 15-week law passed in 2022 stay in effect. But the law that Governor Hobbs is about to sign, it won't take effect for more than 90 days. So the near total ban could at least temporarily be in place.
The repeal narrowly cleared the state legislature yesterday. This is NPR News in Washington.
For Columbia Radio News in New York, I'm Maureen Saint. This morning, Mayor Eric Adams, speaking on NPR, defended the police department's decision to remove protesters from student encampments.
We would have moved sooner on many occasions, but we were clear that we will only do it if the schools call us to do so.
Columbia, CUNY, and Fordham have all asked the NYPD to remove encampments. The NYU encampment still remains despite the threat of suspension. The NYPD's intelligence division has started analyzing footage from the Columbia University and CUNY protests. The mayor's office maintains that over 40% of participants were outside agitators. And with damage to Columbia property, the mayor says his priority is public safety. In Manhattan criminal court, the attorney for porn star Stormy Daniels testified today. Keith Davidson said he negotiated payments with Trump's former personal attorney, Michael Cohen. And meanwhile, Judge Juan Merchan hasn't ruled on additional charges. He said this morning that Trump could face jail time if he continued to violate his gag order. Trump called the judge crooked at a campaign event in Wisconsin yesterday. Migrants who come to New York City who are black face worse prospects in terms of jobs and shelter compared to Latino migrants. That's according to a report released today by three nonprofits working with migrants. The bus companies that brought migrants from Texas to New York were in court today. The city is suing the 17 private companies for the $700 million to cover the cost of shelter and the care of migrants once they reach the city. Manhattan officials are asking for a new bike lane from Franklin Avenue to 59th Street. There's currently 20 blocks in that stretch which are fully unprotected. And for the weather, enjoy the warmth now. It was in the 80s today, but tonight it will drop to the 50s and remain cooler over the weekend. For Columbia Radio News, I'm Maureen Saint.
Pro-Palestinian protests have been taking place on college campuses across the country, including on our own, Columbia University. There's a long history of student protest on college campuses, from anti-Vietnam War demonstrations in the 60s to anti-apartheid protest in the 80s. But how effective are these protest movements, and how are they often remembered? I spoke to Donna Fisher, the author of Saving Ourselves from Climate Shock to Climate Action, a book about the effectiveness of civil disobedience with regard to the climate crisis. We spoke about how protests, like the ones going on at Columbia, can spark social change.
What we're seeing right now on college campuses around the United States is civil disobedience, which is a tactic. It's a type of protest that involves breaking the law, but when it's nonviolent, it is nonviolently breaking the law, right? And occupations and encampments certainly fall in that category. In general, this kind of tactic can be quite successful, but frequently it takes a while for an occupation or an encampment or, you know, civil disobedience to really squeeze those in power to make the kind of decisions and take the kind of actions that are being demanded.
I'm curious what sort of demands usually are the types that might lead to there actually being a, you know, a response and social change.
In general, social movements are more successful the more specific their demands are and the more feasible they are on a shortened timeline. Divestment itself is a very long struggle, and it takes usually years to get universities to divest, partially just because of the process through which divestment has to happen. So the idea that a divestment demand from student activists could be responded to in any successful and effective way quickly is just very hard to fathom, right? Which is not to say that those demands are good or bad, but just to say that the timeline is always quite long.
And I'm curious how media plays a role in perceptions of protest.
Because the media is like the megaphone in some ways, because only so many people can hear when you yell. But when the media is there, it can help to have that information reverberate around. A lot of folks who are engaging in civil disobedience define success of their tactics when they get media attention for their cause. And if that is a measure that folks want to use, certainly the encampment and the occupation on Columbia University's campus has been extremely successful. I mean, another thing that we could use as a measure of the success is the degree to which we're seeing it spread and diffuse across the country. So even if it's not achieving its broad long-term goals, the fact that we're seeing it replicated so many places across the country is a very good indication of success.
I think what was interesting was when the NYPD was first brought onto campus here, I think it actually in some ways bolstered the movement and bolstered the students' both visibility and, you know, support by the general public. And I'm curious, you know, to what extent repression can actually strengthen protest movements and to what extent, you know, it can diminish them.
There is an extensive history about the ways that repression in almost all cases expands a movement and does not stop a movement. So it usually escalates violence and it also turns out many more people. And in the summer of 2020, after George Floyd was murdered, we saw repression happen in many cities around the country. The most well-known and well-documented case was here in Washington, D.C., where Donald Trump called out the National Guard to tear gas peaceful protesters in Lafayette Square. But you may not know this, but the people turned out the next day, more than twice as many people were in the streets, right? Repression does not stop protest. What it does is it brings out sympathizers. What I also think is very interesting is how not just the media, but also the way that the state is playing a role in trying to affect perceptions of different types of protests. Certain elected officials completely criticizing the ways that activists on Columbia's campus took over Hamilton Hall. And somebody on social media was calling out these elected officials who basically saw the exact same thing happen on January 6th, except those folks were armed. And they had actually literally built guillotines out on the grounds of the Capitol. So there was no question about what they were intending. In this case, these were, you know, protesters who had been peaceful, who were now destroying property. So there's a lot of different ways that not only the media, but the political sphere can distort the communication that's coming out and therefore affect our perceptions of what is acceptable protest and what is not.
Once again, this was Dana Fisher, author of Saving Ourselves from Climate Shock to Climate Action. She is also the director of the Center for Environment, Community, and Equity and professor in the School of International Service at American University.
The student-led protests for Columbia to divest from companies that do business with Israel have made headlines around the world. These protests have been loud, visually striking, and have disrupted student and faculty members' daily lives.
To some New Yorkers, the idea of activists using disruptive tactics to bring attention to a cause sounds familiar. The AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, otherwise known as ACT UP, is an activism group that formed in the late 1980s to combat the HIV/AIDS crisis. ACT UP practically created the instruction manual for creative confrontational protesting.
But what might be less well known is that ACT UP is still around today, and it is evolving to encompass a broader range of cases, including Palestinian rights. Samuel Eli Shepherd reports on an active group in evolution.
In Bryant Park in early April, around a dozen activists gather by a fountain. Ariel Friedlander is handing out pink KN95 masks and signs that say, fund healthcare, not warfare. They're meeting up before they march to Times Square. On one of the activists' backpacks is a pin with the icon of ACT UP, an inverted pink triangle. Only this version looks like a slice of watermelon with a green rind and black triangular seeds, roughly the same colors as the Palestinian flag.
At any action, there's people wearing their ACT UP merch and wearing those watermelon tees and hats and buttons.
It's only a matter of time.
The protesters arrive at an Al-Quds Day demonstration, Al-Quds being the Arabic name for Jerusalem. And the demonstration is for an end to the war and a future Palestinian state.
It's really inspiring, and it's been really crazy to be a part of.
6 months ago, on December 1st, 2023, ACT UP posted that watermelon pink triangle on our Instagram with the caption, "This World AIDS Day, we cry out, fight AIDS, not Palestinians." A message that Friedlander says is on brand for ACT UP.
It was completely in line with ACT UP's history of protesting. We needed money for HIV treatment, housing, prevention, and it was going to warfare.
It is right to rebel.
Since December, ACT UP has joined demonstrations for Palestine nearly every week. In January, ACT UP voted to endorse the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, or BDS. It's a movement to stop economically supporting Israel. Of course, not everyone sees the connection between AIDS and Palestinian activism as clearly. Ivy Kwan Arce has been a member of ACT UP since the 90s.
Well, the things that frustrate me about ACT UP today are in some ways very similar to the ones that frustrated me since the moment I stepped in.
Kwan Arce supports the Palestinian cause, but she wants ACT UP to stay focused on its ultimate goals, ending AIDS.
I think, yeah, they should prioritize HIV in the front. And I think a lot of people use the ACT UP history and wins as a vehicle to ride that. And that's kind of difficult for me.
Kwan Arce is HIV positive, something that she says is a rarity in ACT UP nowadays.
And if you read the room, you don't see a lot of, like, old-timers there, because this kind of conversation It's painful for us to see that, so they don't show up.
But others say ACT UP has always been anti-war.
So, for example, when the Gulf War first started, ACT UP organized a day of desperation where they occupied Grand Central Station, and their slogan was, "Fight AIDS, not Arabs."
Sarah Shulman is the author of Let the Record Show, a political history of ACT UP New York. She joined in 87, the year ACT UP was founded. She says that in the early days, there was a desperate sense of urgency. People were dying by the tens of thousands.
Well, one thing that's consistent is that people who are endangered are often falsely depicted as dangerous. So whether it's people with AIDS or Palestinians, people who actually desperately need our support and help are falsely presented as a threat.
And just like today, not every demonstration that ACT UP did back then was popular. And Northrop has also been with the group since the early years.
But in general, we tried to be provocative. We wanted to be provocative because we wanted attention to our issues.
ACT UP protests were outrageous and in your face. They poured ashes on the White House lawn and staged die-ins outside federal buildings. And then there was the Stop the Church protest in 1989. When ACT UP disrupted Mass at St. Patrick's Cathedral.
When one rogue member of ACT UP got up on a pew and started screaming, the Cardinal is a murderer, you're murdering us, the whole place went crazy.
Northrop remembers how a friend's mother in the suburbs reacted to coverage of that protest.
And she said to him, "You know, before this, I used to think of gay people as sort of quiet and weak and wishy-washy. But now I know they're strong and angry. Mission accomplished."
Anyone can attend an ACT UP meeting. Attend three and you get to vote. On a Monday night at the LGBT Center, 7 people showed up in person, 10 more on Zoom. Victor Lee facilitated.
It's not as if every single agenda item has to be AIDS related. People submit what they submit, and that's what our agenda is.
Over the 2-hour meeting, they covered pro-Palestine encampments and planned a protest against Moms for Liberty, an anti-LGBTQ group. The meetings always end with the same chant.
ACT UP, fight back, fight AIDS! ACT UP, fight back, fight AIDS!
Victory is coming our way!
Back at the Al-Quds Day demonstration in Times Square, Scott Cantor wears a keffiyeh. Their sign says, "No pride in genocide." Cantor's one of ACT UP's newer members. They joined in January.
In Gaza, it's a public health crisis. There are people living there with HIV, with AIDS, who are not getting the care that they need. Everything is connected, and it would behoove us to view it as that.
Cantor's 27. They came of age in an era when HIV/AIDS can be both prevented and treated, and where ACT UP is immortalized in documentaries and musicals like Rent.
We have so much to thank for ACT UP. And their anger into action has been something that we can only hope to replicate today for AIDS activism and beyond.
The causes they are fighting for might be changing, but that ACT UP anger is as loud as ever. And if these activists ruffle a few feathers with their actions, well, hey, maybe that's by design. Samuel Eli Shepard, Columbia Radio News.
It's been 5 years since the city announced it would open new jails in several boroughs as part of its efforts to close Rikers Island. One of the largest will be built in Manhattan's Chinatown.
The jail is said to become the tallest in the world, and people are worried it may deter tourists to the neighborhood and harm the local economy.
Demolition of the current building starts earlier this year. Local leaders say residents say the jail is already causing damage. Uptown Radio's Christina Makaya reports.
The new jail in Chinatown is being built here, in the middle of Baxter Street, at the former site of the Manhattan Detention Center, also known as the Tombs. Demolition is nearly over.
You want to take a walk? Come take a walk with me.
Yeah.
Let's take a walk. Walk over this way.
Speaking is Edward Kuchia, a lawyer working next door to the jail site. He's putting his hand on a wall in his office.
The jail is right behind us. This is a back wall, and it's just kind of easier to visualize it. So come on over this way.
Now he's heading outside.
So that, remember that wall I touched? Or that was paper? That's here.
Cooch is pointing to a concrete wall that separates his office and the massive bulldozers and rubble next door.
The cracks were in this wall. You could see the sky. Well, you could see the sky through the wall. That's not good.
The cracks he's referring to are damages made by the demolition. Cooch's firm even had to close for a bit when the demolition started earlier this year. It was just too loud.
There were a good 5 or 6 days where the noise sounded like a jackhammer was next, physically like 2 feet away from you. That's how bad it was.
And for a neighborhood that struggled with bias and hate during COVID, and before that, Hurricane Sandy, and before that, 9/11, Cooch says,
it's just mind-numbingly stupid. I blame de Blasio, who came up with this nonsense. I blame Eric Adams, who, when he was campaigning for mayor, stood right where we were standing, right on the corner of Center Street, and said, the demolition of these buildings is an act of anti-Asian hate.
Jan Lee remembers his promises, too. He's the co-founder of Neighbors United Below Canal and has become known as the jail guy for being the jail's most vocal opponent. And at the meeting about the start of the demolition in August, he was there to remind Eric Adams.
Mr. Mayor, you stood with us in Chinatown to talk about our jail when you were a candidate. And you said to us that the building of a mega jail in Chinatown is a continuation of institutionalized hate against Asian Americans and against Chinatown. We would like to know if you would commit to us in Chinatown having serious input in the creation of this jail.
And in response, Eric Adams promised Jan Lee that the city would support Chinatown in developing a different plan, one that doesn't involve demolishing the old jail.
Yes, you would be engaged in a conversation. Reach out to the other council persons who don't have a jail in their municipality, and those of us who don't want dangerous people back on the street to assist us in figuring this problem out with a plan B, because there was never a plan B in place, and that was a big mistake.
But it's been 9 months, and Jan Lee says Mayor Adams hasn't brought Chinatown into the discussion.
This idea was conceived by people who are not architects. They don't know how to build a jail.
Chinatown knows a thing or two about jails. It's had one on this site since around 1840, and the history hasn't been great. Because the area used to be a swampland, previous jails have actually started sinking. The most recent building was from the 1980s, and according to Jan Lee, that last jail, the one that's now been demolished, it was still usable.
So when we said adaptive reuse, they don't know whether or not that's a good idea or a bad idea because they're just not experts. We're the neighborhood that has lived with jails for 100 years. So when we talk about the dangers to our community, the dangers of how it is to build on that site, no one wants to hear about it.
The new jail in Chinatown is just one of four that the city has mandated so it can close Rikers Island, which some describe as one of the worst jails in the country. With a terrible record of inmates dying, the new plan aims to create more humane jails, not on an island in East, but jails closer to friends and family and the courts.
We understand that Rikers Island is absolutely a horrific place that needs to be changed. And we are willing to bear some of that responsibility of making that change happen.
And the Chinatown jail is expected to hold more than 1,000 people. It'll be 40 stories tall, the tallest in the world.
We have to be able to tell people this is extremely dangerous to build a big jail here.
The plan B that we had hoped to have was the renovation of the existing towers.
Alice Blank is the vice chair of Community Board 1, which includes Chinatown. She's also an architect. In fact, Blank says the community board brought in its own architects to review the city's plan for the new jail, and the city refused to consider their ideas.
Why not? What changed? I'm not sure where we go from here. I'm not sure, you know, what the next steps are, but I clearly think there were problems and they haven't been solved.
Blank is particularly disappointed in Mayor Adams.
He did make clear several times that he didn't really think this was a good idea. He really thought as a community, he might actually do something about this and he might actually stop the work that was being done. But that didn't happen.
So Edward Kucha, the lawyer whose office is next to the site, says whenever it happens, a new jail is the last thing Chinatown needs.
We are oversaturated with things like jails. There's right now 8 homeless shelters and 3 methadone clinics in Chinatown. They don't pick up our garbage. We are besieged by rats. This is typical of a minority neighborhood.
Half of Chinatown's previous jail is gone, and the timeline for building a new one keeps being pushed back. It was supposed to be 2027. Now the city says more like 2029. Christina Makaya, Columbia Radio News.
And now for another one of our personal perspective series. It's easy to see all the ways our colleague Dean Condaleo is a good student. He always has been. Well, almost. Dean tells us about a bad patch that ended up teaching him a valuable lesson, perseverance.
Up until eighth grade, teachers always told my parents that I always had a smile on my face and I was a pleasure to have in class. Then my dad got sick. He had to have open heart surgery. Diving into puberty mixed with this heavy bit of news wasn't a good combo. I became an unruly student, to say the least. Homework became Call of Duty and Grand Theft Auto, studying became texting girls, and I was no longer a teacher's pet. While my dad was at Mount Sinai recovering, I went to Friendly's with some of my classmates. I got a Reese's Peanut Butter Cup sundae. It was Christmas break, my dad was getting better, and my friends and I didn't have a care in the world. After filling up on ice cream, I went home. I opened the front door and saw my mother's face. She was holding my report card. I had C's straight up and down, and she was crying. My heart was pierced. My mom already had my dad to worry about, and now I'd let her down too? I let my family down? For what? Even worse, the Catholic high school entrance exam was only a few months away. It had been my dream to attend Chaminade High School, the Harvard of Long Island prep schools. So many successful people went there, Senator Alphonse D'Amato, Councilman Anthony D'Esposito, and even Bill O'Reilly. I remember watching him on TV, and being a TV anchor had been a dream of mine. If I could just go to Chaminade, I'd be set. I'd be the host of 60 Minutes, live in a penthouse in the city, and drive a Lamborghini. It's the type of school where if you didn't put them as your first choice on the entrance exam, they'd flat out reject you. I studied like crazy. After a few months, I heard back from my backup schools, accepted, accepted, accepted. But all I cared about was getting into my top choice, Chaminade. Finally, a letter from the prestigious all-boys Catholic high school came in the mail. I was so nervous. Dear Dean Joseph Condaleo, we regret to inform you. You can guess the rest. I was devastated, but I wouldn't take no for an answer. I logged onto our family computer and opened up Yahoo Mail. I wrote over 40 emails to teachers, coaches, priests, politicians. I wasn't going down without trying. I had the county executive, town supervisor, our local Little League commissioner. I had a roster of people vouching for me. One night, our home phone rang. The caller ID said, Chaminade High School. I was frozen. Hello?
Good evening, Dean. This is Brother Tom from Chaminade. I'm calling to urge you to save the trees and stop sending letters.
Then he told me what I'd been dreaming about. I was accepted. I tried not to shout in excitement. Today I'm in journalism school, studying to be a multimedia journalist. If I need an expert for a story, I'll sometimes contact dozens of academics in one day. If I'm cooking one of my mom's recipes and I need a special Parmesan cheese, I'll take a 40-minute subway ride to the right Italian-American market. And I've written 40 drafts of this essay. I may not be hosting 60 Minutes yet, or have that penthouse or Lamborghini I dreamed about as a kid. But I do know one thing. I'm going to keep trying, again and again.
In a couple of weeks, Dean will be graduating from Columbia's journalism school. He's applied for 20 jobs, and counting.
We're rooting for you, Dean. And to any prospective employers out there, trust it. Trust me, he's a great hire.
We're back. The time is just after 4:30. You're listening to Uptown Radio. I'm Claire Davenport.
And I'm Dominic Hall-Thomas. Coming up, a new bill aims to protect models from financial and sexual exploitation.
And the Freeze Art Fair is on. The high-profile event takes place in the Shed, not a place you store yard equipment, but a venue in Hudson Yards. And it keeps getting compared to the much more established Venice by NLA.
That's all coming up soon, but first, the news.
In New York, I'm Samuel Eli Shepard. Hamas is sending a delegation to Egypt to continue negotiating a ceasefire with Israel. In a statement this morning, Hamas spokesperson Ismail Haniyeh said negotiations are moving forward with a positive spirit. U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken spoke to PBS this morning.
If Hamas purports to care about the Palestinian people and wants to see an immediate alleviation of their suffering, it will take the deal.
The current proposal is a 40-day temporary ceasefire. It would involve the exchange of Israeli hostages for Palestinian prisoners held without charge or trial in Israel. President Joe Biden spoke out this morning about the pro-Palestine student protests across the country. He says students have the right to peacefully protest, but drew clear limits on what he saw as acceptable.
Vandalism, trespassing, breaking windows, shutting down campuses, forcing the cancellation of classes and graduations. None of this is a peaceful protest.
Today, police cleared the pro-Palestine encampment at UCLA. That was preceded by violence Wednesday morning, after pro-Israel counter-protesters launched fireworks into the encampment. Over 200 people were arrested. The student protests have spread beyond the U.S. In Canada, University of Toronto demonstrators began an encampment today on the university's downtown campus. In Europe and the Middle East, similar protests and sit-ins have occurred on campuses in England, Lebanon, France, and Greece. Organizers of Eurovision announced today that they reserve the right to remove any pro-Palestinian flag or symbol from this year's concert, which begins in Sweden on Tuesday. Michelle Rovarelli, head of communications for the European Broadcasting Company, said that audience members can only bring in flags representing participating countries and the rainbow flag. For months, pro-Palestinian advocates have pushed for the exclusion of Israel from Eurovision this year for the country's role in the war in Gaza. Russia was excluded from participating in the 2022 contest for its invasion of Ukraine. The Department of Justice began delivering their closing arguments in D.C. this morning as part of the antitrust lawsuit against Google. These will continue tomorrow. The DOJ is suing Google for creating an illegal monopoly on search engines. Google counter-argues that it is simply delivering the best product. This trial, which has been a four-year process, could have massive implications for other big tech trials, like Meta, Amazon, and Apple. And cut loose, a degrees of Kevin Bacon gene has been discovered in fruit flies. Scientists at Nature Communications published new research Tuesday showing that there could be a genetic basis for how central what they call gatekeeper flies are to their social networks, just like actors have 6 degrees of IMDb connections to actor Kevin Bacon. It's a sunny day in New York, with cloudy conditions and rain expected this weekend. Grab some vitamin D while you can. For Columbia Radio News, I'm Samuel Eli Shepard.
We're in the midst of this historic third week of the first ever criminal trial of a former president. You guessed it, Donald Trump. He's been accused of falsifying business documents to hide a hush money payment made to porn star Stormy Daniels in 2016, leading up to a presidential election. Uptown Radio's Pascal Hoog was in the courtroom for the proceedings, and he joins us this afternoon. Pascal, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Claire.
There was an interesting exchange before the jury entered the courtroom this morning. Tell us about it.
That's right. Before the trial resumed this morning, Justice Juan Merchan held a hearing for what prosecutors allege are violations of the gag order placed on Trump. We know the former president is prone to speaking out on social media and making public statements, and the judge has previously stated that he doesn't want Trump's comments to interfere with due process, and that this gag order barred him from making comments specifically about witnesses and jurors. But prosecutor Christopher Conroy says Trump made 4 violations of his gag order. This included a comment that the jury selection process had been rushed and that 90% of jurors were Democrats, and 2 instances where Trump accused potential witness Michael Cohen of being a liar. Conroy asked the judge to find Trump in contempt of court and to fine him the maximum penalty, $1,000 for each violation, for a total of $4,000.
Not a lot compared to Trump's other multi-million dollar legal woes. And what did the defense say in response?
Well, the defense lawyer, Todd Blanche, pointed out that this is an exceptional moment. Here, you have the presumptive nominee for a major party who is actively campaigning for the presidency being tried in a criminal court. Because of this, the media attention Trump attracts means that literally his every move is scrutinized. And here, Blanche made his point. To make his point, he pointed to the journalists at the back of the courtroom. And so Blanche says it's not possible for his client to avoid responding with no comment to every question he gets about the trial, including those he gets about witnesses. He's asking the judge to consider, where's the line? What constitutes political rhetoric of a political candidate versus that of a defendant in a criminal trial?
Were there any additional highlights from the hearing?
Yes. One moment that drew laughter in the overflow room where I was seated was when the defense presented posts from Michael Cohen's Twitter feed mocking Trump. There were several photos that presented Trump in an orange jumpsuit, as well as tweets in which Cohen seemingly gave Trump a nickname, which I cannot repeat here on the radio. This was part of the defense. Blanche argued that Cohen was essentially daring Trump to respond, and that because of this, Cohen was, quote, not a man who needs protection from a gag order. In response, Justice Merchan told Blanche that the issue wasn't Cohen, but the message that Trump sends to witnesses and jurors, which is that he has the power to make potentially derogatory comments about a witness.
What did the judge decide?
The judge didn't rule on whether Trump had violated his gag order in these four instances, but he also didn't seem to buy all of the alleged violations. He said he wasn't too concerned about a comment Trump made about witness David Pecker, but he seemed to take Trump's comment about the jury seriously. Merchan didn't indicate when he would make his decision.
Well, never a boring day in court. Pascal, thanks for the update.
Thank you, Claire.
We're reporting today from our studio, and the campus here is pretty much empty. The university gates are locked, and access is extremely limited. Classes and final exams are remote until the end of the semester. On Tuesday night, at the request of Columbia University President Manoush Shafiq, police officers, many of which were in riot gear, cleared pro-Palestinian protesters from the campus. This was the second time police were called onto campus in the last 2 weeks. How have we gotten to this point? Our reporters Fahima Degia, Desiree Nick-Farjam, and Claire Davenport were there, and they join us now. Welcome, everybody.
Thank you.
Claire, take us through the events leading up to the second police intervention.
The protests on campus have been going on for a while now, but things really began to escalate on Sunday when negotiations fell apart after days of talks. The administration said they were not going to divest from Israel, which was one of the protesters' key demands. They also gave demonstrators an ultimatum, which was to leave the encampment on the university lawn or face suspension. And then a little after midnight early on Tuesday, protesters took over Hamilton Hall and barricaded themselves inside.
So, for listeners who might not know, why Hamilton Hall?
So, there's a history of student protesters occupying Hamilton Hall. In 1968, anti-Vietnam War protesters here occupied the same building, and the administration also called in police, with over 700 arrests. And now those protests are something Columbia advertises on its website.
So the president's office has said that inviting the police onto campus again for a second time was because, at least in part, of outside agitators. Is that true?
Yes, the administration and the mayor say bringing police on campus was necessary to remove these outsiders. But as of now, they have not released enough evidence to corroborate these claims, and protesters maintain the occupation was led by students. They also said protesters had broken doors and damaged property, which were acts of destruction, and that the protests had driven hate speech on and around campus. And the university had already made it clear they wanted the protesters and the encampment gone by graduation. For weeks now, as we've walked to our classes and in the studio, we've been able to see scaffolding and equipment for the ceremony stacked up around the tents on the lawn.
Desiree, let's talk about what happened yesterday. So can you just set the scene for us a little bit?
Well, following a press conference by NYPD Commissioner Edward Caban in the evening, there was a sense that police presence was imminent. Here's what he said.
Once the university asks for our help, the NYPD will be there ready to assist them.
As the sun was going down, protesters had linked arms in front of Hamilton Hall, and some of the protesters occupying the building leaned out of the windows on the upper floor to watch. They sang and chanted. A few in front of the building were crying quietly. It was calm and quiet. Then we heard the police sirens from Amsterdam before we saw them, and we knew they were about to come in.
And so then the police did, in fact, arrive. Fahima, what happened next?
Police began making arrests. To be clear, the arrests made outside of the campus gates were not necessarily student protesters, but members of the general public. But once police arrived on campus, they quickly removed members of the press, protesters, and legal observers. Some people ended up locked in dorms. Others were pushed out of the school gates onto Amsterdam Avenue. Hamilton Hall was emptied.
So the people who had been occupying Hamilton Hall, what happened to them in the end?
Well, I spoke to some protesters after they were released. They'd been members of a human chain who'd been guarding the front door of the building. They said police were using aggressive tactics when removing them. Tactics include pushing a protester against a wall, throwing two protesters on the concrete ground, not giving people medical attention when they needed it. Sources told me people were maced and one person fell down the stairs. Over 100 protesters were arrested, and many are still in the process of arraignment.
And how did the night end for you all?
Once police had finished making their arrests, getting back onto campus took a while. I didn't get back until 1:30 in the morning. I should be clear that I don't live on campus, but some students who did had to wait in line to get back on. I'd estimate maybe in about an hour, police were escorting everyone, students and journalists, who wanted to get back onto campus.
I managed to get back on a bit earlier, escorted by police and some journalism faculty. Claire and I saw the encampment being dismantled as we walked back. It took about an hour to clear it. Sanitation trucks had pulled onto campus, and we watched public safety officers throw big trash bags filled with items from the encampment and tents into the trucks.
It sounds like it was a long night for everybody involved. Claire, Fahima, and Desiree, thank you all for your reporting. There are just weeks left to pass the Fashion Workers Act, a new bill hoping to regulate New York's fashion industry. It focuses on models. They may seem to be living enviable lives, but many models aspire to the same labor rights as the rest of us.
This bill has been in the works for 3 years. Currently, there's no union for models, no real HR protections. Its authors say that as some of the most exploited employees in the business, the bill would offer workplace protections and financial transparency. Maureen Saint asked those who've seen the less than glamorous reality of the fashion industry what would change with the new law.
A few streets away from Fifth Avenue's luxury flagship stores, the model-turned-documentary filmmaker Shayna Danziger greets me in the parlor of an apartment. The space has a hippie style, wooden shelves and an orange plush sofa. It's the office space for a fashion magazine where Danziger often works. Before transitioning behind the camera, Danziger was a model for 11 years. She strutted many catwalks and graced the glossy pages of Vogue, Harper's Bazaar, and French Playboy, to name a few. Her first experiences showed her how few professional protections there are for models.
And every contract I ever signed with an agency, I just signed it, gave it back to them. Because if you question anything, they won't sign you. You raise questions, you stop working.
Danziger is part of the Model Alliance, the nonprofit campaigning for this bill. They say this type of harmful behavior would be less common if the Fashion Workers Act was in place.
Because there will be recourse for models. Models would be able to report bad behavior to the Department of Labor, and agencies would be penalized.
Under the new bill's requirements, models would be able to file complaints without the fear of retaliation, like being blacklisted by their manager. If a management company did retaliate, they'd likely be fined, which is consistent with the way other employers are treated under New York state law. The bill aims to also protect models on set, something Danziger works hard to do.
It's just the most basic of things. It's like if someone is changing on my set, like there's a designated changing area so they're not changing in front of all of the crew.
Is that not always the case?
In modeling, never. At least when I was modeling, especially backstage at shows, you're just in a massive room changing with every other girl there, and everyone imaginable is walking through.
The new law would allow models to have a chaperone and requires clients to protect their safety with a zero-tolerance policy for abuse. But it's not just backstage where models may be vulnerable. This workforce is predominantly made up of young immigrant women, often aged just 16 to 18 years old. And sexual assault has long been a rampant issue. When the Model Alliance was crafting this legislation, they kept this dangerous problem in mind. Ashley Grace is a former model and actress turned child and adolescent development professor at California State University.
So many of Harvey Weinstein's victims were young models. And this bill would protect those people, would have protected those people in so many ways.
Agencies often front expenses for expensive international flights, test shots, housing, but there can be a lack of transparency, which means that young people, often teenage girls, can unknowingly rack up debt with their agencies, charging them inflated or mysterious fees. And unless they're supermodels, their paychecks are likely modest. This means they can end up owing their agencies more than they earn. But its authors say the new legislation would prevent agencies from deducting any fees beyond their agreed upon commission. And it would provide a commission cap for agencies of 20%.
The financial elements of this bill would have allowed for some of these young girls to not have been in the financial desperate state that ended up in the situation where they were going to dinner with somebody or a meeting with somebody for the promise of bettering their career if they had fair pay and in the first place.
Grace says the Fashion Workers Act could have protected her when she started out. Grace was sexually assaulted aged 19 at a photographer's apartment on a fashion shoot.
That moment, safety changed for me in my entire life. And I had never questioned before that I would be in situations where I would be in danger because I kind of just trusted the people that were sending me places. And once this horrifically traumatizing situation happened to me, everything changed and I could no longer feel safe.
This bill is the first of its kind and it's ambitious. However, there are still loopholes. Former model turned lawyer Caitlin Puccio is a specialist on modeling contracts. She says if passed, the Fashion Workers Act would at least start to regulate the industry.
And there is power in numbers. So if models would refuse to sign contracts that were so oppressive that could get them into so much trouble, that would have a major effect on agencies because agencies don't make money without models working.
Many of the past models I spoke with while reporting this story said that because of the airbrushed ads and glossy layouts we see, there's a misconception about how they're treated. But in the end, they're subject to the same workplace problems as the rest of us. They hope the bill progresses to a vote in the State Assembly next month. Maureen Saint, Columbia Radio News.
The Freeze Art Fair is back in New York for the 12th season. This year, the art fair will be at the Shed by Hudson Yards.
Galleries will exhibit their work in hopes of selling them to buyers. But you can also go just to appreciate the art. Uptown Radio's Christina Makaya visits Freeze to see how they're shaking up the art world.
It's day two of Freeze New York, and art lovers are flocking to the Shed, the art fair's new venue since abandoning their world-famous tent on Randall's Island. It's a quick walk from Chelsea's gallery scene, and a long line of well-dressed visitors are walking in. They're a bit early. This year's gallery is a little bit different from the previous ones. The new director, Christine Messio, has partnered with Vote.org to encourage visitors to exercise their right to vote. And ahead of this year's presidential election, Freeze is making sure people are registered. And they're doing it with QR codes on water bottles.
These are like metal recyclable cans.
That was Danielle Johnson. She's running the Vote.org stand on the top floor of the Freeze Art Fair. She explains why the metal water bottles say banned in black bold letters.
After the 2020 election, the state legislation in Georgia, they banned passing out food and water to voters who were waiting in line for the polls. So we named them banned just to kind of take back the word and shed light on voter suppression.
When scanned, the QR codes take you to the Plan Your Vote site, which reads, "It is absurd that we can give away water bottles at an art fair, but not to people waiting in long lines to vote," which is a clear reference to the ban in Georgia in 2020. The site also provides information about registering to vote and getting absentee ballots.
It has information about like voter registration, state legislation, and just trying to make sure everybody is well educated about what's going on.
But in typical art fair fashion,
a lot of people came and asked questions. People would ask me like, is this an art piece? And I was like, well, if you interpret it that way, I guess it could be.
But people aren't just excited about the art. They're also happy to come to the shed.
It was easier to get to than Rondell's Island. I love this space, so I'm curious to see how they've used it. I think it will be laid out really nicely. Everything they do here is done very intentionally and creatively, so I'm excited.
Deborah Aberall came to the Freeze Fair last year and thinks the new Manhattan location has its benefits.
I think it allows for a bit more creativity. Breaking it up can help with the monotony sometimes of seeing so many rooms back to back.
And Mauro Bonacina, who came yesterday to the fair's invitation-only premiere, agrees.
I think it's much more convenient. It was incredibly annoying to get there and back. And the shed is, I guess, much more intimate. I'm excited to see the changes that galleries have done overnight and then to see something that I didn't see yesterday.
Bonacina is a London-based gallerist. Unlike Deborah, he's here for some business.
I won't be buying anything today. I'm stealing something if I can. But.
Can we blame him? The works are going for millions of dollars. Unfortunately for Mauro, Ken Vargas is on the scene. He's been working security for Freeze for the last 12 years.
The art, try to protect the art for the artists as best as we can. That's the main concern.
His advice for first-timers?
Keep your mind open. Walk around and enjoy and just be open.
As of today, Freeze New York is open to the public until May 5th. Christina Makaya, Uptown Radio News.
The Professional Women's Hockey League, or the PWHL, is in its inaugural season. It's been a long time coming. There have been multiple failed attempts to create a women's hockey league in the past. But as the season comes to a close, Dean Condaleo reports there are still some problems left to tackle.
It's a Monday night in March at UBS Arena on Long Island. The air inside is cold. New York fans are at the edge of their seats. Their team has been on a 7-game losing streak. And tonight, they're up 3-2 against Boston on home ice with seconds left. New York maintains possession. That's it. There's the horn. New York wins! New York wins!
Something about getting women together. There's always a different atmosphere with that.
Sierra Margie's is a new fan of hockey. This arena is normally the home of the Islanders, and Margie had been to one Islanders game before and started getting into watching hockey that way. But then she'd heard there was a league for women players.
But I think it's just the fact that there's always that little girl inside that just wants to like jump up and be excited, and guys get to do it with sports, and now girls will too.
Margie's is one of the many women fans here today. Some are holding signs drawn in purple and turquoise magic marker, a combination of the league and New York's team colors. The signs say, "Now I can play," and "Pros that look like me." But there are guys here, too. Fans like Nick Petrelli. He doesn't care who's out there on the ice. He just loves hockey.
Honestly, I'm just here for more hockey. I'm just loving it. It's a great time.
And there's another reason Petrelli loves these games. Most ticket prices for New York's team top out at around $30, and that's just to sit a few rows from the ice. In case you don't know, that's way cheaper than tickets to watch the men's team play in the NHL. Those can go up to a few hundred each.
Right now, I think the ticket prices are great. It's really encouraging for fans to come.
In the past, there had been multiple women's leagues internationally, but there'd been a long-running problem. Athlete talent was diluted. The PWHL is the first time the best players from around the world are no longer scattered around. They're now united in one top-notch league. But New York's team is the underdog, Seats are often empty at games, and the team is also facing larger problems that the league as a whole is dealing with too. One of the biggest is athletes' pay.
I mean, I wouldn't say that they're paid fairly.
Carly Wetzel is with Voice in Sport Foundation, a nonprofit that advocates for gender equality in sports.
It's kind of hard with sports because there's so many factors that influence the salary of any individual player. But if you're looking at it from like a completely objective view of like, are you getting paid for the same amount of work? The answer is no.
The Professional Women's Hockey League is owned by one major investor, a hedge fund CEO, Mark Walters. He also has a stake in major men's teams like the Los Angeles Dodgers and England's Chelsea soccer team. But despite the major investment, the average player earns $55,000. That's about the same salary as an NHL team mascot. Another problem is the disproportionate media coverage for women's sports. Jada Mumju knows about this firsthand. She played professional basketball in Turkey for almost a decade.
Media was ignorant to the existence of women's sport. If you don't cover it, the public can't find it.
Now, Mumju teaches women's sports marketing at the University of New Haven. She says, as sports fans increasingly use social media, one thing has gotten better for women players. They can now promote themselves more easily.
Opportunities. So we were in a position, media controlled the ecosystem, media controlled the viability of women's sport as a business. And now, because our lives are digitized, we're not reliant on linear TV. We're not reliant on print media if they would have the courtesy to cover a story. No, women's sport has been the best kept secret, and I am so glad it is no longer a secret.
Far from being a secret, overall, the new league is having a lot of success. When tickets went on sale for a recent game between Toronto and Montreal, they sold out. 21,000 seats in just 20 minutes. At the same time, the teams don't even have names yet. All the teams, Montreal, Toronto, Ottawa, Minnesota, Boston, and New York, all have the same jerseys with their city name diagonally across the front. And the only other difference is the color schemes.
Here we are. But we did not want to wait until next year, 25, or even later this year in 24, because the players have waited so long for this. They've done the dream.
That's Billie Jean King. In case you don't know, King is one of the greatest tennis players of all time and lifetime advocate for women in sports. The Billie Jean King Foundation is helping to back the new league and support women athletes.
It's given them an opportunity to be in hockey that they never thought they'd have. And for women, it says a lot. I mean, it's been over 100 years since the NHL started. Mm-hmm.
For decades, female hockey players have been in a sort of limbo when it comes to playing professionally. After playing at the collegiate level and even representing your country in the Olympics, there hasn't been a sustainable next step. New York's team doesn't have a permanent home. The players split home games between Bridgeport, Newark, and Long Island. Madison Packer is a forward on the New York team. She says not having a home base makes it difficult for PWHL to stand out, especially in a sports market like New York.
When your home base is these different places, it's hard to establish a solidified and unified fan base. I've been in this market for 9 years now. It's hard. There's a lot of sports teams here. You're competing with men's sports. Women's sports are still trying to get the respect and notoriety that they deserve.
Would you say that PWHL athletes are paid fairly?
Equal pay, and equal does not mean same. We will never be paid the same as the men. It's just not, it's not going to happen. But are we going to make enough that it to make a living and have it be a career? Yeah, we're there.
Packer has a second job outside of hockey. She's an executive recruiter. That's on top of being a mom to two kids. She says if you want to support women's sports, there's an easy answer.
You got all these people on Twitter and online all the time saying that we're not paid more. Well, come to the games, you know, buy tickets, buy merch, support us. Supporting women is buying from them.
The New York team is at 8 wins and 15 losses. They're playing this Saturday back at UBS Arena, their last game of the season. Packers hoping for a win. Dean Condoleo, Columbia Radio News.
Yesterday, New Jersey was hit by the latest in a series of small aftershocks. They're all stemming from the 4.8 magnitude earthquake that shook New York last month. It was the largest earthquake to hit the tri-state area since 1973. Scientists on the East Coast have continued to monitor the activity, so I spoke with one, a seismologist, to see if we are in store for more earthquakes. Raymond Russo, you're an associate professor of geological sciences at the University of Florida. So you must be used to studying larger earthquakes than the one we've just had in New York a few weeks back. Tell us, is it unusual to have earthquakes in this part of the U.S.?
It's actually not very unusual. There are quite frequent small magnitude earthquakes all up and down the eastern seaboard. They are usually not felt. The truth of the matter, though, is that the population of earthquakes with regards to magnitude is like a pyramid. So at the low end of magnitude, there are many, many, many events. But those many events are telling us that there's always the possibility of larger magnitude earthquakes. It's rare, but it does happen.
We have continued to see smaller earthquakes or aftershocks in New Jersey. The most recent was yesterday. Is that pretty common for them to continue going on for, you know, almost a month? Would people have even felt it?
Generally not. I think it's a little bit more rare for smaller earthquakes to have an aftershock series, but certainly big earthquakes will have aftershock series that can go on for even a year. So basically, if you think about what's happening here, you know, the Earth has moved suddenly on some kind of fault plane. And so areas that have slipped relax stress, but areas that have only partially slipped haven't quite done all their work. And so you can think about that as kind of the aftershock series happening because there's just a little bit more stress that needs to be released, and therefore we get this earthquake. There's always a possibility that it's actually leading to yet another even bigger earthquake, in which case the things that we're calling aftershocks all become foreshocks. I would suspect that if this goes on much longer, people would start to get a little bit more concerned about exactly that possibility. But again, you know, the aftershocks that are happening here do seem to be slowing down and the magnitudes are small. So probably not.
How do people start predicting them? And can we predict some coming up in New York?
Here's the thing. So many different phenomena will affect the levels of stress in the Earth. We're limited to the surface of the Earth or very near the surface of the Earth in our observations. The faults are deep or deeper than we can usually get to. It is extremely expensive to do fault monitoring.
Because there's just so many factors involved.
Yes, you need to dedicate lots of equipment to a permanent location on the ground in a place where you don't know that an earthquake's going to happen. Then you have to wait. What we can do is we have a reasonably good idea of where these major faults are. We can then predict reasonably well how big an earthquake is this fault system likely to produce. And then engineer your buildings, educate your population to withstand, to be resilient in that kind of shaking.
So you think it's unlikely that residents in New York and New Jersey will have to do much kind of altering of their homes to plan for earthquakes in the future?
I doubt that there would be a significant effort in upgrading current infrastructure in the area. On the other hand, everybody can do the minimum preparation. For example, many people are injured in an earthquake because something in the home falls on them, right? Having moved lots of books recently, you don't want the bookshelf falling on you.
Raymond Russo from the University of Florida, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed talking to you.
Claire, have you ever heard of the spotlight effect?
Yes. Actually, no, I made that up. Never heard of it.
Yeah, I mean, me neither until pretty recently. But it's basically where you overestimate how much other people pay attention to you. And I feel like that's something I have quite a lot. Very vain, I know. But I've developed a pretty solid go-to level of mortification for even the slightest embarrassing slip-up as a result of this spotlight-like effect.
It's very British of you.
I know, and it's really not great. Well, we've been developing these personal stories for our broadcast, The Commentaries, and now it's my turn. I've spent quite a lot of time thinking about the level of unnecessary embarrassment that I put myself through. I still don't really know when it started, but I think I know why it started. I think the reason even mild embarrassment sticks to me like glue is because of my parents. Naturally, you blame your parents. When I was growing up, my parents were social workers, you know, the type, always conscious of other people, putting other people first, like it was their job or something. And they installed those same values in me. But sometimes that isn't actually a good thing. I think I spend too much time worrying about how I'm affecting others, when in reality, most of the time, I'm not affecting people at all. Okay, so it's time for a story. In 2019, I'm working in a bar in Bristol. that's really close to the university. Every year around September, the place is flooded with parents dropping their newly minted students off on their university adventure. In early afternoon, a young woman walks up to the bar with a much older man. He must have been in his early 50s with thin gray stubble and deep wrinkles around his eyes and mouth. "I'll have a pint of IPA," he says with a smile. "And a pint of cider for me," the woman said. She looked barely out of her teens. "Of course. Do you mind if I see some ID first?" I asked the woman with my politest tone. The woman swung her bag around her shoulder, her brow frowning as she began rummaging through it, before producing a small green driver's license. "I know," I said, chuckling to myself, scanning the numbers on the card for her birthday. "It's embarrassing being ID'd in front of your dad, isn't it?" His face turned deep red, then to anger. "Oh, he's not my dad," the woman says, looking unimpressed. "He's just my older boyfriend." My heart sank. A deep embarrassment flooded my body, I cannot tell you. It felt like every ounce of confidence I had built up over the course of my years was suddenly stripped away. But why? It wasn't that big of a deal, right? All I could do was pour their drinks and avoid their table for the rest of the afternoon. In the years since, I can physically feel my back tighten when I think about that. But when I tell my friends the story, the response is, "Yeah, that's bad, but they probably don't even remember it now." And they're right. I've obsessed over them much more than they will have obsessed over me. And that's if they obsessed over me at all. Until coming to New York, I hadn't really told that story that much. I haven't really thought about the amount of unnecessary embarrassment I had harbored. There's an anonymity to this city that I haven't really felt anywhere else, certainly not in Bristol, certainly not in London. If you can walk down the street in New York and see a man covered in pigeons or a Spider-Man hounding tourists for photos, the last thing you'll remember is a normal-looking man mistaking a boyfriend for a dad. Now, I just need to remember that too.
Wow, Dom, thank you for sharing. Hearing all that got me thinking, should we try to tackle your embarrassment right here, right now? A bit of exposure therapy, if you will?
I'm going to be completely honest with you. I have been dreading this for the entire show.
I want you to read something really uncomfortable. You wrote this poem last night and sent it to me. Wait, 1 minute. I have it here. Okay. I'd like you to read it on the air.
I genuinely can't believe I'm going to do this. It's called Al Dente, An Ode to My One True Love. "I love your versatility. I love your figure. I love how you soften with time and work well with others. Pesto, peas and cheese. This is my ode to pasta. Yes, I'll have seconds, please."
That was really uncomfortable.
I know, that was truly dreadful. I cannot tell you.
Dom, you're an embarrassment of a friend, but that's why I like you. Okay, that's it for this edition of Uptown Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show.
Our executive producers today was Tommaso Baronio. Leading our staff of reporters was senior producer Desiree McFarjum, joined by assistant producer Zoe Yee. And shaping up the edition was senior editor Fahima Degia, with the help of assistant editor Cecilia Blotta.
Director Zoe Yee coordinated our studio production team. In charge of webcasting and socials was Dean Condaleo. Working the board was Julia Leo, and on soundbite was Irina Humanuk.
Delivering our newscasts were Maureen Saint and Samuel Eli Shepherd, and day reporters Pascal Hoag and Christina McKea brought you the latest on the ground in New York. Our personal perspectives were brought to you by myself, Dominic Cole Thomas, and Dean Condaleo.
Our instructors, Sally Herships, Carrie Donahue, and Priscilla Alibi, advised our staff. And we're your hosts. I'm Claire Davenport.
And I'm Dominic Hall Thomas. Uptown Radio is live Thursdays at 4. Join us next time for the last one. But you can always find us at uptownradio.org. Until next time, and from all of us here at Uptown Radio, thanks for listening.